Welcome to Mary's Cup of Tea, the self-love podcast for women, though all self-lovers are welcome here. I'm your host, Mary Jolkowski. I'm an author, speaker, retreat leader, and all-around self-love advocate. And this is the podcast that will inspire you to love yourself. Hello, self-lover. Before we dive into today's podcast episode, I want to make sure you know about my two books on self-love. If you're struggling with body image or self-acceptance, then I highly recommend you check out my first book, The Gift of Self-Love. It's a comprehensive workbook to help you build confidence, recognize your worth, and learn to love who you are. Thousands of people have this book, and the 5-star reviews are so amazing. They give me so much life. So I hope that this is something that can help you too. You can get it wherever books are sold by searching for The Gift of Self-Love or go to my website, maryscupoftea.com/book. After releasing The Gift of Self-Love and reading all your positive feedback, I realized that we really needed something to keep us going every single day. So not a deep dive workbook, but maybe like a micro dose of self-love in your daily life, which is why I wrote 100 Days of Self-Love. It's a guided journal with, you guessed it, 100 prompts that cover so many areas of life, including body, identity, purpose, emotions, mindset, relationships, and more. So you can really think of it as a metaphor multivitamin, something to keep you going, or as I like to say, growing on your self-love journey. You can get this journal wherever books are sold as well by searching for 100 Days of Self-Love or go to maryscupoftea.com/journal. It's my mission to share all the self-love tea with you, so I hope that both my books and this podcast can do just that. The biggest thing I learned on my journey of recovering from bulimia and binge eating and restricting interwoven into that vicious cycle, the biggest thing I learned is that it's not about the food. It's never about the food, and it never was about the food. There are deep emotional roots that are tied to disordered eating. And our guest today, Dr. Anita Johnston, is actually a repeat guest. So this is a part two of our conversation. Dr. Anita is the author of Eating in the Light of the Moon, which is a book that I incessantly recommend to those struggling with disordered eating. I've posted it on my Instagram a ton before, and it's one that's, you know, it's like spiritual woo-woo, but in the best way possible. And it makes sense, right? Because if it's not about the food, then what is it about? Well, it's about those deep emotional layers, those deep spiritual layers. And Dr. Anita's approach leans on storytelling and metaphors to really help you see the bigger picture of your struggle with food and body image and how to come out on the other side of that. So in part one, we talked a lot about recovery in general, a spiritual approach to it. And today in part two, we zoom into bulimia and binge eating specifically. Anita Johnston, she's a PhD in depth psychology, a certified eating disorder specialist, and author of Eating in the Light of the Moon, How Women Can Transform Their Relationships with Food Through Myth, Metaphor, and Storytelling. It's been published in 7 languages. Dr. Anita Johnston is a pioneer in the field, and she's been treating eating difficulties and body image distress for over 35 years. She is the founder and currently executive director of Aipono Hawaii Eating Disorders Program, which has a residential program in Maui. She is co-creator of the Light of the Moon Cafe, an online resource with interactive and self-study courses for women around the world. She is best known for integrating metaphor and storytelling into her training as a clinical psychologist to explain the complex issues that underlie disordered eating behavior and other struggles with eating and body image. If you're interested in her approach, I recommend getting her free food metaphor guide. So if you're struggling with your relationship with food, this is a great place to start. I'll put the link in the description. And if you're, you know, in recovery or perhaps consider yourself recovered, I still find this topic so fascinating. I kind of like look back on how my eating disorder developed and what it took to heal. And Dr. Anita does a beautiful job of putting together pieces of that spiritual and emotional puzzle that comes with dealing with body image and disordered eating struggles. In this episode, Dr. Anita talks about her childhood growing up on the island of Guam and how unique that was in the 60s. She also, this is my favorite part, she talks about her first ever psychology class, and you're not going to believe who her professor was, who literally informed her approach to treating eating disorders for the next 3 to 4 decades. And then she talks about her professional expertise on common personality traits of those who struggle with disordered eating, the role of anger in recovery, and the one skill you need to effectively process anger, how to address emotional patterns that lie beneath bulimia and binge eating. And at the core, what Dr. Anita specializes in is using storytelling and metaphors to help us heal. And I think we need that soft, spiritual, some might call it more feminine approach in our very rigid, structured, masculine-driven society. After this, please go listen to my first interview with Dr. Anita. It is so, so rich, so, so good. I think you're going to really, really learn a lot from both part 2 and part 1, but I think part 1 is a bit longer and the content is totally different. So definitely head over there, episode 240, also with Dr. Anita Johnston. Without further ado, please welcome Dr. Anita for a part 2 on Mary's Cup of Tea. Hi, Dr. Anita. Welcome to part 2. I'm so happy that we're doing this again.
So am I. We had such a good time last time.
We did. And I actually re-aired your episode in February because that's kind of the month where eating disorder awareness is out there.
Well, February is my birthday month, so.
Mine too.
Oh, really?
Wait, are you an Aquarius queen also or Pisces?
I'm a Pisces.
That makes so much sense. Something new I've been doing on the podcast is asking guests, what is your proverbial cup of tea? Just something small that you're enjoying lately.
Well, actually what it is I make rose sorbet. And so when I want to feel like I can just kind of be, often it's with that.
How does one make rose sorbet?
Well, first you need a rose bush that's organic.
Okay. Right. Step one, become a gardener.
Right. And then you put it all in a blender and with some lemon juice and some sugar. And it's beautiful. It's magenta, which is my favorite color. So and then put in an ice cream machine and it's fantastic. I love eating flowers.
That sounds delicious. Did you say you put the roses themselves or how do
yeah.
you get them?
Oh yeah, it's the roses.
You can eat that?
Yeah. So I have an edible flower garden, so that's kind of my thing. I like eating flowers.
This is the funnest fact that has ever come from this question. Well, as I mentioned in part 1, we really focused on like a broad overview of your spiritual approach to eating disorder recovery. And today I wanted to zoom in specifically on bulimia and binge eating. And I was listening to a talk of yours at an ashram. Oh my goodness.
In the Bahamas, right? Yeah.
Just casually at a yogic ashram in the Bahamas. It was probably one of my favorite ones of your speeches and lectures. The reason why I particularly loved it so much is because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming your audience members there weren't necessarily those who you explicitly knew were struggling with disordered eating. Is that correct?
Right. It was just people that wanted to understand what was underneath it all.
It is so spiritual and like everybody eats.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody eats. Everybody has a relationship with food. You talked about how you lean on storytelling and metaphor, which is like your main approach. And I'm curious from a psychological perspective, how or why does storytelling and metaphors, why do they click in our brains?
Mm-hmm. Well, they click in our brains, for starters, because we are story creatures. We understand things through stories, whether it's the story of our life or a story we've been told by somebody. So our brains over eons have developed particular, they call it story architecture. So our brains are structured to understand things in story. And metaphor is the language of story. And we use metaphor. Metaphor is not just something poets use, right? We use metaphor when we describe, we use one thing to describe another that for one reason or another is difficult to put into words. And so with the struggle with disordered eating, sometimes it's difficult to put into words those invisible forces that are driving the disordered eating behaviors and thoughts. And metaphor is the perfect vehicle for that.
How did you come to this? Because I've heard from friends and followers who have told me that they've been in treatment centers where it was so dry, so clinical, so like, just eat these meals that we give you. Those kinds of experiences I feel like are common. So the fact that your center offers this very deep spiritual approach, how did you decide on that or land on that?
Well, first of all, it started a long time ago. So we're talking back in 1982. There was no field of eating disorders. There were a lot of people struggling, and I was living in Hawaii at the time, and I was supervising a psychology intern who was doing her doctoral dissertation on the incidence of eating disorders in Hawaii. And every time we got together to talk about it, and we were joined by a social worker who had had her own recovery experience, but she'd had to figure it out herself. There was nobody to help. And so we started talking about this and we said, oh my gosh, there's so many people that are struggling. There should be a center for this. And after we said it for about the fifth time, we looked at each other and we went, I guess we're it. So that's how it began for me. It was really you created and they come. And girls and women of all ages, all sizes, all ethnic groups, all different kinds of struggle, but all of them struggling with food, eating, and body image in some way. In those days, no guys were showing up. And so I just became really curious. First of all, why was it girls and women? Why was it these particular girls and women? And why was the struggle around food and body and eating? And so back then, very little was known. Karen Carpenter had just died from anorexia. So people knew what anorexia was. Bulimia had just been brought into the DSM. Binge eating wasn't even considered as a thing. And so what I had to do is I had to listen as carefully as I could to the stories of these girls and women that came to see me to see if I could find, okay, what is the common denominator? What is it that even though these are very different individuals, what is driving these behaviors and these thoughts? And so that's how it began for me, was by listening to their stories.
Have you personally had any experiences?
No, but I should have, because I have the personality. You see, what I discovered is that these individuals were very emotionally sensitive, highly intuitive. But we live in a world that not only doesn't value that, but doesn't teach you how to maneuver with that level of sensitivity. So they thought that there was something wrong with them. And then they went on a diet and they went, oh yeah, I know what's wrong with me. I'm too fat, or I can't stay on this diet. And so that began the journey of the eating disorder. That's my personality also. But strangely enough, I did not grow up with anyone dieting. I grew up on the island of Guam in the 1950s and 60s. And people weren't dieting then. And I remember thinking, did I miss something? And I was talking to a friend of mine who we grew up together. And I said to her, I said, hey, you know, do you remember, were our mothers dieting? She goes, no, nobody dieted. And I went, that's what I thought. So I think that's how I was able to just miss that, because there was no dieting when I grew up. You figure this was shortly after World War II. And during World War II, the island was occupied by the Japanese military, and it was a very brutal occupation. And food was very scarce. So food was something you were lucky to come by. People were trying to survive. They weren't looking in any mirrors. There weren't any mirrors. So it was a very different era. And Guam was about maybe 10 to 15 years behind the rest of the U.S. So dieting just wasn't a thing. If you go back 100 years ago, you're not going to find a lot of dieting. I grew up at a time where people were just happy to be free.
Mm. That's really powerful. The beauty standard tends to be that which is least accessible or which is like harder to achieve. And so in times and places where food was scarce, it was actually considered more desirable to be plump and well-fed. Can you tell us about the first psychology class that you ever took?
Yeah. So mind you, I was born and raised and grew up on the island of Guam. I did not leave until I was a junior in college. So I was, you know, pretty naive in some ways. And then I went on to graduate school. The first class I walked into, there's this little old man in front of the class, and he was speaking in an accent that I knew he was speaking English, but it wasn't an accent I was familiar with. Now, unbeknownst to me, this was Viktor Frankl, and I didn't know he was famous. I didn't know anything, right? I'm just coming in pretty green. And it was probably the most profound experience being his student, because for those of your listeners that don't know who he was a psychiatrist that during World War II, he was in the Nazi prison camps, where he lost his family, his parents, his siblings, his wife. And he wrote a book which is considered one of the most profound books of the century, called Man's Search for Meaning. And what he discovered out of his experience there is that a person can lose everything that they have ever held dear, but there's one thing that can never, ever be taken away from you, and that is the meaning you give to your experience. And in that meaning lies your freedom. So when I first started trying to understand eating disorders, that was forefront in my mind. What does this mean? What is the meaning? And what is the meaning as a collective, but also what is the meaning for each of these individuals? And so it profoundly affected the way I work with disordered eating and really led me to metaphor.
I'm just fangirling so much. I can't believe you got to meet him. And it's just, I mean, what was that experience like taking class from him?
I was in awe. I mean, every day it would be like an insight or something I'd never considered. I'd never even thought of. I remember I thought, what is he talking about? Because he was talking about, amusement parks. And then I started to realize, oh, he's talking about, you know, how people are looking for meaning, but in these very shallow ways, by accumulating things and not appreciating that it's a much deeper endeavor.
From your experience, what are those hidden spiritual, emotional drivers of people struggling with bulimia specifically? And then I'd like to ask you the same question about binge eating, if they're different.
Yeah, you see, I believe that there isn't that much difference when you go that deep. The fundamental issues, I think, are the same, which is again, you think of someone that's born very emotionally sensitive, highly intuitive, but they don't know what to do with those emotions because they're rather intense and they can be overwhelming and scary and painful. And so the eating behaviors can take different forms, but ultimately it's an attempt to stuff, as in the case of binge eating, or purge, as in the case of bulimia, or restrict, as in the case of anorexia, emotions that you don't know what to do with. So, for example, with bulimia, though, when you are emotionally sensitive, highly intuitive, you're what I call thin-skinned. And one of the problems with that is you tend to absorb other people's feelings. So the eating behaviors and thoughts are an attempt to, like I said, either stuff or purge or restrict feelings that either aren't yours or are overwhelming for you.
This makes total sense. And I really see myself in that. I host retreats for women. And one question that I had asked in our sharing circle is, what's something you don't allow yourself to feel? Mm-hmm. And one quite profound answer that I heard is anger.
Oh, yes.
Specifically with female anger. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that's not allowed.
It's kind of an interesting thing because we do live in a culture that discourages those who identify as female from expressing anger. It's interesting, though, that guys are discouraged from expressing more tender feelings. So, you know, they don't have it any better. But at any rate, we live in a culture that is so literal that it doesn't understand invisible things, right? So emotions are one of those invisible things. Well, I'm saying things, but they really aren't even things. We can't hold anger in our hands or sadness or fear. They're waves of energy is what they are. And they are designed just like waves in the ocean to come in, peak and pass, come in, peak and pass through us. But we don't know this. So, for example, with anger, we don't know how to let it just move through our bodies and go on its way, especially if you've had experiences that have linked anger with violence or anger with cruelty or distorted anger, which is expressed maybe passive aggressively. So what happens is we go, whoa, I don't want anything to do with that. And yet, anger is a really important emotion to experience. For example, one of the things that anger does is it lets us know if somebody is trespassing. If somebody is acting as though our physical or our emotional or our mental or our spiritual space is just someplace else for them to walk or hang out. So when someone tells you that you shouldn't feel what you're feeling, or you shouldn't think what you're thinking, or that your spirituality should be a certain way, or if they touch you and you don't want to be touched, anger is what alerts us to that. It's anger that lets us know a boundary has been crossed. So it's a very important emotion to have. Once you learn how to work with it, and work with the energy of anger so that it can inform you about how to respond. Hmm.
I wish I had you to hear this when I was little. And for those of us who, like I said, are maybe doing that post hoc analysis and healing, what are some ways that we can effectively feel, heal, process anger specifically? Because I really see the way it relates to bulimia and binge eating. It's this like really intense, and anorexia too. It's this like intense self-punishment.
Mm-hmm. Great question, because I think, and I've seen thousands of people totally, completely recovered. Period. I don't care if they've been struggling their entire lives and they're now in their 60s or 70s, or if they have the most severe eating disorder you could possibly imagine. I've seen total, complete recovery. However, I've never seen it without the skill of assertive communication, which is exactly the skill you need to express your anger in a way that honors your experience, but also honors the experience of another person. So with assertive communication and anger, it involves the ability to identify, accept, and express your anger in a way that is respectful of you and respectful of the other person. I believe so strongly in this that I created a formula that a person can use to learn this language. And ideally, you learn to express your anger when it's in its milder forms, because it's easier to handle then. So when you're feeling irritated or annoyed or frustrated before you become enraged, right? Because it's, you know, when you're enraged, that energy is so strong, it's really hard to work with it. So the idea is to recognize it early on and express it early on by communicating assertively.
That reminds me of a similar approach that you shared with us in part one of nourishing our bodies. I watched this clip so many times that I have it memorized. You said, "What's the physical sensation of feeling hunger?" And a lot of people say they feel their stomach growling or they can't think straight. And you say, "No, that's not hunger. That's famished." We need to learn to honor our hunger before we get to that point. It seems like emotions are kind of the same way, which is how it all connects.
Exactly. Yes. But sometimes we don't recognize it until it's boom in our face. And it's like, we want to rip someone's head off and we're horrified that we want to rip someone's head off or say mean things. And that's where I think it's important to have a place to dump it. And I recommend when you're feeling furious, when you're feeling enraged, go to your journal or whatever device that you might write on and let it out. And you might even write an FU letter to the whoever it is that you're angry with. This is not a letter you ever send, okay? Its purpose is to get it out of your body, to get it out of your system. And you can say, "And another thing, and then you did blah, 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 and I, you know, this really upset me." I mean, you just go on and on and on and on and on. So you dump it. And then you go back. And now you want to see if you were to assert yourself, how would you do that now that you've just dumped it? You've spewed it onto paper. Nobody's going to get hurt, right? And then you can go back and you can say, you know what? Put it in the formula, which is first you find what are the facts. When you said that you were going to call at 7 and didn't call until 10:30, these are the facts, right? Not when you ignore me like that. It's like, no, what were the facts? The ignoring is your interpretation already, and we will get to that. But you start off with the facts. So when you say you're going to call at 7 and you don't call until 10:30, okay, what's the feeling? I feel annoyed. Okay, you just find one feeling, and sometimes it's hard. It's like, well, what do I feel? I feel annoyed. Okay, how come them not calling me until 10:30 stirred up this feeling of annoyance? Because it gave me the impression that you didn't appreciate what a tight time schedule I had. Because it seemed to me that you were blowing me off. Because I got the idea that I wasn't that important to you. You find what it is. This is magic. This is pure magic when you can do this. It's not easy, because to find out why that particular behavior stirred up this particular feeling in you requires some soul searching. Maybe because it reminds me of the things my mother used to say when she was angry, whatever it is. But it frees you. It allows that feeling to flow on through, because you go, oh yeah, I see why.
Overall, it might sound simple, but as you're painting the example of what to do. It takes me back to all those times I didn't assert myself or didn't set a boundary or didn't say no when I didn't want to do something, only to then come home and binge eat.
Of course. Of course. Because remember, energy has to go someplace. Energy just doesn't disappear. And anger is a form of energy. It doesn't just disappear. It's got to go someplace. And so we find some way to relieve that tension that gets created when we're acting one way and inside we're feeling another. Because mm-hmm. that's ultimately the vacuum in which the eating disorder comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're disconnected from our authentic self.
Hmm. What are the hidden spiritual and emotional drivers of people struggling with binge eating specifically? I think that's the eating disorder that is least likely to receive help. So a lot of people listening might have had to kind of hodgepodge their way through healing on their own. How would you approach somebody struggling with binge eating?
Yeah. So again, I really do like to look at the whole spectrum so you can see the difference and you can see metaphorically what those patterns mean. With someone, for example, who's struggling with anorexia, they're restricting their food. Why does someone restrict? They restrict because things feel like too much. It is not just the food that's too much. They want to restrict their emotions. They want to restrict new experiences. They want to restrict their sexuality. There's all kinds of things that seem like too much they want to restrict. Someone who binges and purges, they're someone that takes on too much, gets overwhelmed, and then has to get rid of it. So it's not just with food. It's they might sign up for a gazillion classes, get overwhelmed, and drop out. Or they might meet someone, fall madly in love, and as soon as they see a flaw, they're over it. Or they might take on a bunch of projects and then get overwhelmed and not finish any of them. Or they might make a best friend, and as soon as there's conflict, they ghost them. So this binge purge process exists as a pattern in other areas of their lives. It gets our attention with food, but it's not an isolated thing. And someone who's struggling with binge eating, you find the experience of not enoughness everywhere. It's not just that there's not enough food, there's not enough money, there's not enough time, there's not enough attention, or there's not enough appreciation, or there's a feeling like they are not enough. And so this gets played out with food. So the patterns, when you move beyond just looking at the literal food, you look at the pattern of, okay, in what ways is there not enough? How is it that they don't know how to get their needs met when someone who is binge eating? And so the only thing that's left is becomes a one-trick pony. I mean, we need to eat. And so that becomes the place everything gets channeled into.
Mm-hmm. That's so me. It's also so multifactorial. You mentioned the not enough money. That was just such a big thing with my family. There's also some historical and genetic influences where my family grew up in communism. So I grew up watching my dad binge eat, like eat food out of the trash. And that had a big impact on the way I see food. And you mentioned that kind of like beg for attention and acceptance. Sounds vain when I put it like that, but as a child, that's how you see the world.
We all need that. And when we feel like we can't get that from other people, then we're going to have to get it through food. If we can't find other people that will comfort us when we're distressed, we turn to comfort food. I mean, that's just kind of how it works in our psyche. And again, when you get conscious of it, then you're able to make some changes. But if you just focus on changing what you're doing with food, you're not going to have lasting recovery, because that's not what it's, the problem isn't the food. The problem is the pattern And you want to see that pattern and where it shows up in other areas and how come. And so with binge eating, we're really looking at scarcity mentality. Scarcity mentality is an interesting thing because you can have a lot of something and still have scarcity mentality around it.
When I was binge eating, the way that I unlearned scarcity mentality was someone I dated was just taking me out to eat a lot. And over the course of a year and a half, like eventually, I think that was one of the things that helped me realize that I'm lucky enough to say that like food will always be probably more or less accessible. So it calmed my nervous system. For somebody struggling with binge eating, how can you unlearn that scarcity mentality or, you know, unpack these unconscious layers? Are there concrete practices or something that you recommend we can start with?
Well, you begin with the awareness that it really isn't about food. It's about not enoughness. And so you might want to say, okay, where in my life do I feel like I'm not getting enough? Where in my life am I not getting enough attention or enough appreciation? Or where am I not getting enough connection with my spirituality? Or where in my life am I feeling like I'm not getting enough excitement? Everything is boring for me. Where in my life is there not enough? And in the beginning, you go, yeah, well, I don't have enough affection, but where am I going to get that? I don't have a relationship in my life with someone who's affectionate. Well, you probably, that's why you're not getting enough affection, right? And so you begin with just the awareness, but then you might say, okay, what would be one little tiny step I could take towards that? Let's take something like affection, right? Because that seems absolutely impossible if you don't have a relationship. But when you really go deep and say, well, what is affection? What is physical affection? Well, it's a connection with your senses, isn't it? When someone touches you, and it's the sense of touch. If that's something you're really craving, what are some little tiny ways you can get that? Well, maybe you could walk outside and feel the sun on your skin. Or maybe you could ride your bike and feel the wind in your hair. So you can start to see that there are ways that that sense that is longing to be fed can begin to be fed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of people with body image rob themselves of affection because they might feel like they don't deserve to feel good in their bodies.
Yeah. And that's why you start with, I mean, everybody deserves to feel the wind in their hair, right? One of the lies that we're all taught is that your worth is something you have to earn. And it's so not true. We're all born. It's our birthright. And this idea that you have to earn it, you have to do something to deserve it. Really? Does someone who is just born have more worth than someone who's older? Does someone who has more money in the bank have more worth than somebody else? Does somebody with a certain body type or color of skin have more worth than somebody else? And when you can really step back and look at it, you can say, well, no, of course not.
Mm-hmm. If you could rewrite or maybe amend Eating in the Light of the Moon, which is a book that I incessantly recommend to people. I actually just saw a comment on that lecture, the one you did at the ashram, and somebody wrote that your book changed their life in 2008. And that was like 15 years ago.
I wrote that book it first got published in 1996. Okay. So some of the stuff that I think that I would emphasize that I really didn't would be more of the diversity kinds of things. I mentioned it a little bit, but not so much. So I think I would really do more about that. I do in my course in the Light of the Moon Cafe, my new Crescent Moon course, we really get into different body types and our lineage and understanding that. I in the courses that I have now, I would do a lot more with body image, but this was information I didn't have back then. And a lot of the information that I was getting from dietitians, there weren't dietitians that really understood eating disorders. And so I would make some changes there. In fact, a lot of people don't know this, but I don't own that book, right? I wrote that book, but I don't own that book. When you get a book published, which is very different from self-publishing, the publisher owns that book. So I have wanted to make some changes, but the publisher hasn't been agreeable. So there's nothing I can do. So yeah, there's some things I would change.
Yeah, yeah. But it also, there's something powerful, I think, of it being marked at that point in time and being relevant 20, is it 30? Am I doing math correct? 20 years later?
It's a while.
30 years later. No, is it 30?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness. I thought I wasn't doing that math correctly, but yeah, literally 3 decades later.
Mm-hmm. Well, the stories are older than that. So I use the old stories because there's an ancient truth that persists in them. For example, we know the story of Beauty and the Beast, but do you know that it's 6,000 years old? 6,000 years old. Why is that? Why would that story continue to this very day? And there are that are children nowadays in 2025 that are still enthralled by it. And that's because there's deep wisdom that has been embedded and tucked in the stories, which is why I use them. These are stories that are going to be around for thousands of years still.
Definitely. And I hope your book will be around for thousands of years too. Where can our listeners find you and work with you?
So you can go to my website, which is dranitajohnston.com, D-R-A-N-I-T-A. johnston.com, or you can go to lightofthemooncafe.com, and that's where I have, that's my online platform where I have different self-study courses and then interactive courses where people can post comments. I respond to all the comments and questions, and I have live calls, and that's really a lot of fun. And you can download my food and metaphor guide, if anyone's interested in that and finding out more about, okay, what are the patterns that I engage in telling me about what is it that I'm really wanting to satisfy? What am I really hungry for?
Mm-hmm. I will put those links in the description too, so people can have easy access to those. And I just appreciate this so much. You're so incredibly generous with your energy.
Well, thank you. I love what you're doing. And it's always fun when we get together, right? Have a cup of tea at the cafe.
Yes, I have mine. Mine's iced today. Cheers. One last thing before we farewell, my self-lovers. If you've been enjoying the Mary's Cup of Tea podcast, I would greatly appreciate it if you could leave a review on Apple or rate the show on Spotify. You can do this by searching for the show, Mary's Cup of Tea, scroll all the way down on Apple Podcasts, and you'll see stars where you can click one of the stars and leave a few kind words. It just means so much to me because I'm so behind the scenes when I'm podcasting, so I don't really get to see the impact of the show unless you leave a review. And on Spotify, there's just a button that says rate the show, and it'll let you put however many stars you want. Your feedback helps the podcast grow, and as someone whose love language is words of affirmation, your kind words mean the world to me. Thank you so much for supporting the show and helping me spread the gift of self-love. I love you all so much, and I will talk to you in next week's episode.